It was almost like entering a cave. We paused inside the entrance to let our eyes adjust. The air was thick with the aromas of long human habitation. There were food smells, stews and smoked meat and spilled wine, and the odour of cured hides and gathered people. It could have been a stench, but it was not. Rather, it was a homey smell, of safety and family. The entrance gave immediately onto a great room with supporting pillars as the only dividers. There were three hearths, all with cook fires on them. The stone-flagged floor was strewn with fresh rushes. Benches and shelves ran around the walls. The lower benches were wide, and the rolled sleeping skins proclaimed that these were beds by night and seating and tables by day. The higher, shallower shelves above the benches held foodstuffs and personal possessions. Most of the light in the room came from the hearths, though there were ineffectual candles in sconces on many of the pillars. In the far left corner, a wide staircase wound up into the dimness. It was the only access I could see to the upper regions of the house. It made sense. Even if an attacking force gained control of this level of the mother's house, the folk above would have only one entrance to defend. Invaders would pay dearly to gain the upper floors of the mother's house. All this I saw through the gathered people. Folk of every age were clustered everywhere, and there was a sense of anticipation in the air. We were obviously late. At the end of the long room, before the largest hearth, Prince Dutiful waited. Ranged on his side of the hearth were Chade and his witcoterie, and beyond them his guard drawn up in three rows. The Narwhal clan folk parted to make way for us to assume our correct positions. Webb and Swift advanced to stand with Cockle the minstrel and Civil and his witcat. I took a place at the end of the front row of guardsmen. Eliania was not there. Those gathered at the other side of the hearth were mostly women. Piotr was the only adult man in his prime. There were a few old grandfathers, four lads about the Narcheska's age, and then six or seven boys ranging down to toddlers clinging to their mother's skirts. Had the Red Ship War so decimated the Narwhal clan? The boar warriors from the ship were present, but they stood in a group off to one side, witnesses to rather than participants in whatever was about to happen. The people who crowded the rest of the room were almost entirely Narwhal clan, as evinced by their jewellery, clothing adornments and tattoos. The exceptions seemed to be almost entirely males standing alongside women, and were probably men who had married into the clan or were partners in a less formal arrangement with a Narwhal woman. I saw bears, otters, and one eagle amongst them. Without exception, the women were strikingly arrayed. Those who did not wear jewellery of gold or silver or precious stone were still bedecked with ornaments of shell, feather, and seeds. The artful arrangement of their hair had not been neglected and added substantially to the height of several women. Unlike Buckkeep, where the women seemed to shift their finery in mysteriously feminine coordination, I saw a wide variety of styles. The only unifying theme to the beaded or embroidered or woven patterns of their dress seemed to be the brightness of the colours and the Narwhal motif. Those in the first circle, I surmised, were relatives of the Narcheska, while those who stood closest to the hearth would be her most immediate family. They were almost all women. All the Narwhal women shared an intent, almost fierce, air. The tension in that part of the room was palpable. I wondered which one was her mother, and wondered, too, what we awaited. Absolute silence fell. Then four Narwhal clansmen carried a wizened little woman down the stairs and into the hall. She rode in a chair fashioned from twisty pieces of gleaming willow wood and cushioned with bearskins. Her thin white hair was braided and pinned in a crown to her head. Her eyes were very black and bright. She wore a red robe, and the Narwhal motif was repeated in tiny ivory buttons sewn all over it. The men set her chair down, not on the floor, but upon a heavy table where she could remain seated and still look out over those who had gathered in her house. With a small whimper of complaint, the old woman straightened herself in the chair, sitting tall and gazing at the folk who had gathered. Her pink tongue wet her wrinkled lips. Heavy fur slippers dangled on her skinny feet.
"Well, here we all are," she proclaimed.
She spoke the words in Outlander loudly, as old folks who are going deaf are prone to do. She did not seem as mindful of the formality of the situation, nor as tense as the other women. The great mother of the Narwhal clan leaned forward, her gnarled hands gripping the twisted wood of the chair arms.
"So, send him out, then. Who seeks to court our Eliania, our Nacheska of the Narwhals? Where is the warrior bold enough to seek the mother's permission to bed with our daughter?"
I am sure those were not the words Dutiful had been told to expect. His face was the colour of beetroot as he stepped forward. He made a warrior's obeisance before the old woman, and spoke in clear Outlander as he proclaimed, "I stand before the mothers of the Narwhal clan, and seek permission to join my line with yours." She stared at him for a moment, and then scowled, not at him, but at one of the young men who had borne her chair.
"What is a sixth duchy slave doing here? Is he a gift? And why is he trying to speak our language and doing such a horrible job of it? Cut his tongue out if he attempts it again."
There was a sudden silence, broken by a wild whoop of laughter from someone in the back of the room, quickly muffled. Somehow Dutiful kept his aplomb, and was wise enough not to attempt to explain himself to the incensed mother. A woman from the Narcheska's contingent stepped to the mother's side and stood on tiptoe, whispering frantically to her. The mother waved her off, irritably.
"Stop all that hissing and spitting, Almata. You know I can't hear a word when you talk like that. Where is Piotr?"
She glanced around as if she'd misplaced a shoe, then lifted her eyes and scowled at Piotr.
"There he is. You know that I hear him best. What is he doing way over there? Get here, you insolent rascal, and explain to me what this is about."
There would have been a sweet humour watching the old woman order the seasoned warrior about, if his face had not betrayed such worry. He strode over to her, went down briefly on one knee, and then stood up. She lifted one root-like hand and settled it on his shoulder.
"What is this about?"
she demanded.
"Oetr,"
he said quietly. I suspect his deep voice reached her old ears better than the woman's shrill whisper had.
"It's about Oetr, remember?"
"Oetr,"
she said, and her eyes brimmed suddenly with tears. She looked around the room.
"And Kosi, little Kosi too. Is she here then? Come home to us at last?"
"No," Piotr said shortly. "They're not here, neither one of them. And that is what this is about. Remember? We talked about it in the garden this morning. Remember?"
He nodded at her, slowly encouraging her. She watched his face and nodded slowly with him, and then stopped. She shook her head once.
"No,"
she cried out in a low voice.
"I don't remember. The alyssum has stopped blooming, and the plums may be sour this year. I remember we spoke of that, but no. Piotr, was it important?"
"It was, great mother. It is. Very important."
She looked troubled, and then suddenly angry.
"Important, important, important, says a man. But what do men know?"
Her old voice, cracked and shrill, rose in anger and derision. Her thin hand slapped her thigh in disgust.
"Bedding and bloodshedding, that is all they know. That is all they think is important. What do they know of the sheep to shear and the gardens to be harvested? What do they know of how many barrels of salt fish for the winter and how many casks of sweet lard? Important. Well, if it's important, let Oetr handle it. She is the mother now, and I should be allowed to rest."
She lifted her hand from Piotr's shoulder
and gripped the arms of her chair.
"I need my time to rest,"
she complained piteously.
"Yes, great mother. Yes, you do. And you should take it now, and I will see that all is handled as it should be, I promise."
And with these words, Eliania emerged from the shadows at the top of the stairs and hurried down to us. Her lightly shod feet seemed to skim each riser. Half of her hair was pinned up with tiny star pins, the rest flew loose to her shoulders. It did not look intentional. Behind her on the stairs, two young women started to follow her, then halted in horror, whispering to one another. I suspected they had been readying her for her appearance, and she had bolted free of them when she heard the raised voices. I recognized her bearing more than her form as people parted to let her through. Like Dutiful, she had grown taller in the months since I'd last seen her, and all her childish plumpness had melted away, replaced by woman's flesh. As she came past the line of her women, I was not the only Six Duchies man who gasped. Her gown covered her shoulders and back, but left bare her proudly up-tilting breasts. Had she rouged her nipples to make them stand so pink? I wondered, and felt my flesh stir in response. An instant later, I had flung up my walls, and "guard your thoughts," I chided Dutiful. He must have heard me, yet he did not flinch. He stared at the Narcheska's bared breasts, as if he had never seen a woman's breasts, and in all likelihood that was possible. She did not spare a glance for him and his gawking, but went straight to the Great Mother.
"I will deal with this, Pyotr,"
she said in her new woman's voice. Then she spoke to the men who had carried her chair.
"You have heard our Great Mother. She requires her time of rest. Let us all thank her for gracing our gathering this evening, and wish her calm sleep and easy bones."
There was a murmur of response, echoing the Narcheska's good night to the Great Mother, and then the young men took up the old woman's chair and carried her off. The Narcheska stood straight and silent, turning to watch after her until she disappeared into the shadows at the top of the stair. She took a deep breath. The prince was now staring at her back, at the knob at the top of her spine, bared by her upswept hair and her graceful neck above it. The seamstress had cut it well, I thought to myself. Not even the edge of her tattoos peeped over it. I saw Chade give Dutiful a tiny jab in the ribs. The young man started as if waking from a dream, and discovered a sudden interest in Pyotr's feet. Pyotr was staring at him flatly, as if he were an ill-mannered dog that might steal meat from the table if he were not watched. I saw the Narcheska square her shoulders. She turned back to face us all. Her eyes roved over the assembly. The ornament in her hair was made from narwhal's horn. I have no idea how they had wrought that iridescent blue upon it. The tiny star pin sparkled around it, and I no longer had any doubt that the carving that Prince Dutiful had found upon the treasure beach had presaged this moment. I was no closer to knowing what that meant, and had no time to think upon it. Somehow the Narcheska had found a smile. It was a bit wry at the corners as she gave a small laugh and a shrug.
"I've forgotten what I'm supposed to say now. Will someone speak the mother's words for me?"
Then, before anyone could reply to her request, she let her gaze come to meet Dutiful's. He had blushed before, now he burned as he met her eyes. She ignored his fluster and spoke calmly.
"You see, we combine two of our traditions tonight. By chance, it is my time to show myself as a blooded woman before my clan. And on this very day you are come here to offer yourself as mate to me."
His lips moved. I think they muttered the words, "blooded woman," but no sound came forth. She laughed, but the lightness had gone out of it. It was brittle, as ice shards breaking.
"Have you no ceremony among your folk for this? A boy bloodies his sword to become a man, no? In his ability to kill, he announces that he is now complete. But a woman has no need of a sword. Edda herself bloodies us, and announces us as complete. What a man can take with a sword, a woman can give by her flesh alone. Life."
She set both her ringless hands on her flat belly.
"I have shed my first woman's blood. I can bring forth life from within me. I stand before you all
a woman now. There was a muttered response of, Welcome, Meliania, Narwhal clan woman. I sensed that she had stepped back into the ritual and taken up the words too. Peyota had retreated into the row of her clansmen. Women came to stand around her, a formalized greeting passed between every woman of the Narwhal clan and Eliania. A group of wide-eyed girls, hair loose upon their shoulders, stood in a cluster watching her. One, taller than the others, and close to being a woman herself, pointed at Dutiful and said something approving to two of her fellows. They giggled and drew closer to her, whispering and nudging one another. I sensed that these girls had been Eliania's playmates and companions, but that Eliania had stepped apart from them now and into the ranks of the women. The effortless way in which she had assumed command of the situation told me that she had, in many ways, been a woman amongst them for a long time. This ceremony was a formal recognition that her body was starting to catch up with her spirit. When every woman had greeted her, Eliania stepped back out of the circle of firelight from the hearth. A stillness came over the crowd, replacing the murmur of comment and welcome. For a brief time I felt their awkwardness. Peyota shifted on his feet, then forced himself to stand still. Dutiful remained where he had been, and I sensed that these minutes were passing like hours for him. Finally, the same young woman who had whispered to the Great Mother stepped forward. A faint blush suffused her cheeks. Obviously she felt she was stepping above her station, but no one else had offered to take charge. She cleared her throat, but there was still a tremor in her voice as she said,
I am Almata, a daughter of the Mothers of the Narwhal clan. I am cousin to the Narcheska Eliania, and 6 years her senior. Unworthy as I am, I will speak for the Great Mother.
She paused a moment, as if to allow time for someone to challenge her in this role. There were older women present, but none of them spoke. A few gave tiny encouraging nods. Most looked heartsick. Almata took a deep breath, visibly steadied herself, and spoke again.
We are gathered in our mother's house because one not of our clan has come among us, seeking to join his lines to ours. He asks not just for any woman, but for our Narcheska Eliania, she whose daughters will in turn be Narcheska, and mother, and great mother to us all. Stand forth, warrior. Who seeks to court our Eliania, our Narcheska of the Narwhals? Where is the warrior bold enough to seek the mother's permission to bed with our daughter and give her daughters to raise up as mothers of the Narwhal clan?
Dutiful took a shuddering breath. He should not have. He should have been steadier than that. And yet I could not blame him. All could sense that something was awry here tonight, and it was something more than foreigners intruding on an out-islander ceremony. I had a sense of people stretching to close a gap, of trying to mend a tragedy by retreating to tradition. Yet there was no space left for us to be cautious. Dutiful's voice was steady as he proclaimed,
I come. I would have the Narcheska Eliania of the Narwhal clan as the mother of my children. And how will you provide for her, and the children that you will give her? What will you contribute to the Narwhal clan that we should let your bloodlines mingle with ours?
And suddenly we were on solid ground. Chade had prepared well for this. Riddle nudged me, and I stepped aside almost in rhythm with the other guards. Behind them was a canvas-draped heap. Longwick dragged the cover from it, and each guardsman in turn took up an item and brought it forward as Chade announced what it was. Dutiful stood silent and proud as his gifts were presented to both Almata and the Narcheska, as well he might be. Nothing had been spared. Some of the trove had come with us, hastily transferred from the maiden's chant to the Tusker. Casks of brandy from Shokes, a bale of ermine skins from the Mountain Kingdom, and coloured glass beads from Tilth, wrought into a tapestry that could be hung over a window. Silver earrings, Katrikan's own handiwork. Cotton, linen, and fine woollen cloth from Bairns were among the offerings. Other gifts were merely mentioned as promises, cargo to be brought from Zillig on the next trip. The reading of that list took some time. The labour of 3 skilled smiths for 3 years, a bull and 12 cows of our finest bloodlines, 6 brace of oxen and a team of matched horses, hunting hounds and 2 merlins trained to be ladies' birds. And some things that Chade offered on Prince Dutiful's behalf were only dreams yet.
trade and peace between the six duchies and the out-islands, gifts of wheat when their fishing harvest was poor, good iron and the freedom to trade in all the six duchies' ports. It was a long list, and I felt the day's weariness catch up with me as Chade catalogued it for them. But all weariness left me when Chade concluded and Almatter spoke again.
This is the offer made to our clan. Mothers, daughters, and sisters, what say you? Do any speak against him?
Silence followed her words. It evidently expressed approval, for Almatter nodded gravely. Then she turned to Eliania.
Cousin, woman of the Narwhal clan, Eliania the Nacheska, what is your will? Do you desire this man? Will you take him as yours?
The muscles stood out in Piotr's neck as the slender young woman stepped forward. Dutiful held out a hand, palm up. She stood beside him, shoulder to shoulder, and placed her hand flat upon his. When she turned to look at him and their eyes met, my lad blushed again.
I will take him,
she replied gravely. A part of me noted she did not reply as to whether she desired him or not. She took a deeper breath and said more loudly,
I will take him, and he will bed me, and we will give daughters to the mother's house. If he performs the tasks I have already named to him, if he can bring here to this hearth the head of the dragon Icefire, then he may call me wife.
Piotr's eyes flickered shut, and then open again. He forced himself to watch as his sister daughter sold herself. His shoulders moved once in what might have been a sob denied. Almatter held a hand out, and someone placed a long strip of leather in it. She stepped forward and continued speaking as she bound Dutiful's and Eliania's wrists together.
This binds you as your words have bound you. While she accepts you, bed with no other, Dutiful, or that woman's life is forfeit to Eliania's knife. While he pleases you, Eliania, bed with no other, or that man must face the challenge of Dutiful's sword. Now, mingle your blood upon the hearthstones of our mother's house in offering to Ada for the children she may send you.
I had no desire to watch, but I did. First the knife was offered to Dutiful. He betrayed no pain as he sliced his forearm until it bled freely. He cupped his bound hand and waited for blood to trickle past the leather strip and into his palm. Eliania did likewise, her face grave and somehow impassive, as if she had transgressed into an area so far beyond disgrace that nothing could move her now. When each hand cupped a small amount of blood, Almatter guided their hands into a clasp. Then they knelt, and each left a palm print of the mingled blood on the hearthstone. When they turned to face the gathered folk again, Almatter freed their hands of the leather cord and offered it to Dutiful, who accepted it gravely. Almatter moved to stand behind them, a hand on each of their shoulders. She tried to put a note of joy into her voice, but it sounded flat to me as she announced,
They stand before you, joined and bound by their words. Wish them well, my people.
The murmur of approval that rose from the gathered folk was more as if they applauded a deed of great courage than if they had just witnessed the happy joining of a loving couple. Eliania bowed her head before it, sacrifice for them in some way I did not yet comprehend.
I'm married.
Wonder, dismay, and outrage mingled in Dutiful's flung skill thought. Not until you give her a dragon's head, I warned him. Not until we hold the real ceremony in Buckkeep Castle, Chade comforted him. The prince looked dazed. All around us, the hall erupted into activity. Boards were brought out, and then food to grace them. Out-islander minstrels struck up a song upon their windy instruments. True to their tradition, the minstrels so twisted the words to fit the tune that I could scarce understand it. I noticed that two of them came to greet Cockle and invite him to their corner of the hall. Their welcome seemed genuine, and again I was struck by the universal understanding that seems to exist amongst musicians. Dutiful skill shared with me the words Eliania had said quietly to him.
Now you must hold my hand and walk with me as I present you to my older cousins. Remember they are my elders. Although I am the Nacheska, I still owe them the deference due to my elders. So do you.
She spoke as if instructing a child.
"I'll try not to humiliate you," he replied, rather stiffly.
His words did not please me, and yet I could not completely blame him for saying them.
"Then smile, and keep quiet, as befits a warrior in a mother's house that is not his own,"
she retorted. She took his hand and let it be obvious that she led him, rather as one might lead a prize bull by the ring in his nose, I thought to myself. The women did not come to meet him. Instead, Eliania took him from group to group. At each he made the warrior's obeisance accepted in the Out-Islands, that is, he offered his sword hand, empty and now bloodied, wrist up to them while bowing his head. They smiled upon him, and offered comments to the Narcheska upon her choice. I sensed that in another time and place the words would have been light-hearted and teasing, but at this ceremony and with this man, the compliments offered to her were moderate and well-mannered. Instead of relieving the tension of the formal pledging, they prolonged it. Seeing the other groups of warriors dispersing throughout the feast, Chade dismissed us from our ranks. "Ears and eyes open," he cautioned me as I wended my way through the throng. "Always," I replied to him. He did not need to suggest that I keep the prince in sight. Until I knew what was behind this facade, I had no idea who might or might not wish him harm. And so I drifted about the wedding feast, never too far from my prince, keeping a light skill contact with him. The gathering was very different from any buckkeep celebration. There was no seating of the guests according to rank or favour. Instead, the food was set out and people helped themselves to it, and wandered the room as they ate it. There was roast mutton on spits, kept warm near the hearth, and trays heaped with fowl cooked whole. I sampled from a platter of smoked candlefish, seasoned and crisp, and remarkably tasty. Out-Islander breads seemed to be dark and unleavened, cooked in huge flat rounds. Diners tore off a piece of an appropriate size, and then heaped it with sliced and pickled vegetables, or dipped it in fish oil and salt. All the flavours of the food seemed overly strong to me, and much of it was pickled or smoked or salted. Only the mutton and the chicken were fresh killed, and even those had been seasoned with some sort of seaweed. The eating and drinking, the talking and the music, and some sort of juggling contest, with betting, all happened simultaneously. The roar of raised voices was nearly deafening. After a time I became aware of something else. Young Out-Islander women of the Narwhal clan were approaching not just our guardsmen, but even Civil and Cockle. I saw several guards grinning fatuously as their young partners led them outside or up the shadowy staircase. "Are they deliberately luring Dutiful's guard away?" I skilled anxiously to Chade. "Here it is a woman's prerogative," he replied. "They do not have the same customs regarding chastity. The guardsmen were warned to be cautious but not cool. The prince's warriors and companions are expected to be available for the evening, but only if they are invited. It would be a breach of hospitality if they approached a woman who had not first signalled her interest. If you have not noticed, there is a lack of men here, and far fewer children than there should be for this many women. An empty womb filled on a wedding night foretells a lucky child here." "Was there a reason I was not told of this before now?" "Does it bother you?" After a moment of surreptitious peering, I located my old mentor. He was sitting on one of the bed benches, nibbling on a fowl's leg and conversing with a woman half his age. I caught a glimpse of Civil and his cat disappearing into the upper reaches of the house. The woman who led him was at least 5 years older than he was, but he did not look intimidated. I had no time to wonder nor worry where Swift had vanished to. Surely he was too young to be of any interest to these viragos. In that moment I realized that Dutiful was leaving the mother's house in the company of a gaggle of the Narcheska's girlish friends. Eliania did not look particularly pleased, even though she still held his hand and led him out of the door. It was not easy to follow him. A woman with a tray of sweets stepped between me and the door. I managed to feign a thick-witted indifference to her offering of more than the sticky confections, as I helped myself to a handful in a boorish display of greed and ate them in two mouthfuls. Somehow this flattered her, and she set the tray aside and followed me as I ate them. She was still at my elbow when I reached the door. "Where's the back house?" I asked her, and when she did not understand the Six Duchies' euphemism, I mimed what I sought. With a puzzled look, she pointed out a low building to me, and returned to the feasting. As I walked towards it, I cast a wide glance for Dutiful. There were several couples in the courtyard, in various stages of dalliance, and two boys carrying water from the well back into the mother's house. Where had he gone? I saw him at last, not far away, sitting beside Eliania on a grassy rise near some young apple trees. The other girls had settled around them in a ring. These were girls not yet women, as their loose hair proclaimed. I guessed that their ages ranged from 10 to 15 or so. Doubtless before this night they had been Eliania's playmates for years. Now she has left their companionship behind her with her change to woman status. "Not quite," Dutiful informed me, sourly. "They have evaluated me as if I were a horse bought cheap at the fair. If he is a warrior, where are his scars? Did he not have a clan? Why does his face not bear her tattoo? They tease her, and one of them is quite a nasty little vixen. Lestra is her name, and she is Eliania's older cousin. She is mocking Eliania, saying that perhaps she is a woman, and even wed in name, but that she doubts that she has ever been kissed. Lestra claims to have been kissed several times, quite thoroughly, even though she has not bled yet. Fitz, have the girls no shame, nor reticence in this land?" I grasped it on an intuitive level. "Dutiful, it is a driving out. Eliania is no longer one of them, and so they will peck and tease her tonight. Doubtless it would have happened in any case. It may even be seen as a part of her womanhood ceremony." And then, needlessly, I added, "Be careful. Follow her lead, lest you shame her somehow." "I have no idea what she wants of me," he replied helplessly. "She glares at me out of the corner of her eye, and yet holds to my hand as if it were a line thrown to her in a wild water." As clearly as if I sat beside him, the words reached me through our skill link. The girl who flung the challenge was taller than Eliania, and perchance older. I knew enough of women to know that age alone did not determine their blood time. Indeed, save for her loose hair, I would have guessed her a woman already. Lestra spoke saucily, taunting Eliania with,
"So, you'll bind him to you? So no one else can have him? But you dare not even kiss him?"
"Perhaps I do not wish to kiss him yet. Perhaps I intend to wait until he has proven himself worthy of me."
Lestra shook her head. She had little bells wired into her hair, and I heard the jingle of her mane as she said mockingly,
"No, Eliania, we know you well. As a girl you are always the most meek and least daring of us. I dare say you are the same as a woman. You don't dare kiss him, and he is too timid a man to take one for himself. He is a smooth-cheeked boy masquerading as a man. Isn't that true, Prince? You are as timid as she is. Perhaps I could teach you to be bolder. He does not even look at her breasts, or perhaps they are so small he cannot see them."
I did not envy Dutiful. I had no advice to offer him. I sat myself down on the low stone wall that marked the edge of the young orchard. I lifted my hands to my face and rubbed my cheeks, as a man does when he has too much to drink and seeks to drive the tingle from his face. I hoped folk would think me drunk and leave me sitting. I did not relish watching Dutiful go through his dilemma, but I dared not leave him. I sagged my shoulders and set my head as if staring into the distance while watching out of the corner of my eye. Dutiful made an effort, speaking stiffly. "Perhaps I respect Narcheska Eliania too much to take what she has not offered." I could feel his steely determination not to look at her breasts as he said this. His awareness of them, bared and warm so near him, was taking its toll. He could not see the look Eliania cast to one side. That answer had not pleased her.
"But you do not respect me, do you?"
the little minx taunted him. "No," he replied shortly. "I do not think that I do."
"Then there is no problem. Show your boldness and kiss me,"
Lestra commanded him triumphantly.
"And I will tell her if she is missing anything worth having."
As if to force him to the act, she leaned forward suddenly, thrusting her face at him, even as one sly hand flew towards his groin.
"What's this?"
she crowed mischievously, as Dutiful shot to his feet with an exclamation of outrage.
"There's more than a kiss he has waiting for you, Eliania. Look at it. An army of one has pitched a tent for you there. Will the siege last long?"
"Stop it, Lestra,"
Eliania snarled. She, too, had come to her feet. Her cheeks blazed with colour, and she did not look at Dutiful but scowled at her enemy. Her bared breasts rose and fell with her angry breath.
Why? You've obviously no intent of doing anything interesting with him. Why shouldn't I take him? By rights he should be mine, just as by rights I should be Narcheska, and will be when he takes you off to be a lesser woman in his own mother's house.
Several of the girls gasped, but Eliania's eyes only blazed hotter.
That is among the oldest of the lies you tell, Lestra. Your great-grandmother was the younger twin. Both midwives said so.
First out of the womb is not always oldest, Eliania, so many say. Your great-grandmother was a mewling, sickly kitten of a babe. Mine was the hearty, healthy child. Your great-grandmother had no right to be Narcheska, nor did her daughter, or her granddaughter, or you.
Sickly? Indeed. Then how is it that she lives still, as great-mother? Take back your lie, Lestra, or I will cram it down your throat.
Eliania spoke in a flat, ugly voice. It carried well. I was not the only one who had turned to watch the quarrel. When Dutiful stepped forward, mouth open to speak, Eliania put her hand flat in the centre of his chest and thrust him back. The young girls formed into a ring now around the potential combatants, and he found himself outside it. He looked toward me as if for help. Don't intervene. Eliania has made it plain that she doesn't want you to. I hoped my advice was good. Even as I attempted to skill the situation to Chade, I saw Pyotr. He had probably been lurking just out of my line of sight at the building's corner. He strolled over to the low wall where I sat and leaned one hip on it casually.
You should stay out of that, he said to me casually.
I swung my head and regarded him blearily.
Who?
He stared at me, levelly.
Your prince. He should leave this to Eliania to settle. It's woman's business, and she won't welcome his interference. You should convey that to him, if you can.
Pyotr says, step back from it, let Eliania settle it.
What?
Dutiful demanded in consternation.
Why is Pyotr speaking to you?
Chade demanded.
I don't know.
To Pyotr I said, I'm just his guardsman, sir, I don't advise the prince.
You're his bodyguard,
Pyotr replied pleasantly.
Or his... what would it be in your language? His chaperone? As I am for Eliania.
You're good.
But you're not invisible. I've seen you watching him.
I'm his guardsman. I'm supposed to guard him.
I protested, letting the words slur a little. I wished I'd thought of having a glass of wine. The smell of spirits can be very convincing. He was no longer looking at me. I turned to stare up the hill. There was a shout behind me from the door of the mother's house, and I heard other people emerging. The two girls had gone into a clinch. With apparent ease, Lestra threw Eliania onto the ground, on her back. Even at that distance I heard her breath whoosh out of her. Pyotr made a frustrated sound, and he twitched in that small way that experienced fighters do when they are watching a prized student compete. As Lestra flung herself on top of Eliania, the smaller girl suddenly drew her knees up to her chest and firmly kicked her opponent in her midsection. Lestra shot backwards, landing badly. Eliania rolled to her knees and, careless of her fine gown and coiffed hair, flung herself on top of Lestra. Every muscle in Pyotr's neck and arms was taut, but he did not move. I came to my feet to gain a better vantage and gawked, just as the other Buckkeep guardsmen were doing. The Outislanders who had emerged to watch the struggle were interested, but not intent. Evidently, for girls or women to wrestle in this manner was not shocking to them. By sitting high on Lestra's chest, her knees on her arms, Eliania had effectively pinned the larger girl to the earth. Lestra was kicking and struggling, but the Narcheska had gripped a handful of her loose hair to fix her head to the ground. With her free hand, she rubbed a handful of dirt into Lestra's mouth.
"Let honest earth cleanse the lie from your lips!"
she shouted triumphantly. Dutiful stood back from them, his mouth ajar. He was aware of the wild jiggle of Eliania's bared breasts as her chest heaved with exertion. I sensed he was as horrified at his physical reaction to that as he was by the girl's struggle. All around them, the other girls leapt and yelled, encouraging the combatants. With a wild shriek, Lestra tore her head free of Eliania's grasp, leaving her clutching a goodly handful of hair. Eliania slapped her hard and then seized her by the throat.
"Call me Narcheska, or you will not draw another breath," she shouted at her.
"Narcheska! Narcheska!"
the older girl shrieked, and then she began to sob wildly, more from frustration and humiliation than pain. Eliania put her hand flat to Lestra's face and pushed up off it as she stood. "Leave her alone," she warned two of the girls who stepped forward to aid the loser.
"Let her lie there and be glad that I didn't have my knife. I am a woman now. From now on, my knife will answer anyone who dares to dispute that I am Narcheska. From now on, my knife will answer anyone who dares to touch the man I have claimed for myself."
I glanced at Pyotr. His grin was hard, showing every tooth he had. Eliania reached Dutiful in two strides. He stood gawking down at his disheveled bride. As casually as I would seize a horse's mane to mount him, she reached up and gripped his warrior's tail. As she pulled his face down to hers, she commanded him, "You will kiss me now." An instant before their mouths met, he snatched his skill awareness away from me. Yet neither I nor any man watching needed the skill to sense the fervor in that kiss. She locked her mouth to his, and as his arms came awkwardly around her to draw her closer, she leaned into his embrace, deliberately brushing her bared breasts against his chest. Then she broke the kiss, and while Dutiful drew an uneven breath, she met his eyes and reminded him, "Icefire's head, on my mother's hearth, before you may call me wife." Then, from within the circle of his embrace, she looked at her old playmates and announced, "You girls may stay here and play, if you wish. I'm taking my husband back inside to the feasting." She stepped clear of his arms and took his hand again. He followed her docilely, grinning vapidly. Lestra was sitting up, alone, staring after them with fury and shame. There were approving whoops from several women and some envious groans from the watching men as she triumphantly led her prize past them. I glanced at Pyotr. He looked stunned. Then his eyes came to mine. "She had to do that," he told me sternly, "to make her point with the other girls. That's why she did it, to establish herself in their eyes as a woman, and to make clear her claim to him." "I could see that," I agreed mildly, but I did not believe him. I suspected that something had just happened that was outside his plan for Eliania and Dutiful. It made it all the more essential for me to discover just what his true intent was. The rest of the evening seemed bland. Eating, drinking, and listening to Outlander bards could not compare to the claiming of power that I had just witnessed. I found a meat pie and a mug of ale, and took it to a quiet corner. I pretended to be absorbed in it as I skilled to chade all that I had witnessed. "This is moving more swiftly than I had dared hope," he skilled in return. "And yet I mistrust it. Does she truly want him as a husband, or was it only to establish what she claimed, that no one can take him from her? Does she hope lust will spur him to kill the dragon for her?" I felt foolish as I told him. "This is the first time I have realized that if she becomes his bride and moves to his house, some will say she has forfeited her place here. Lestra spoke of her becoming a lesser woman in his mother's house. What did it mean?" Chade's reply came reluctantly. "I think the idiom is the same used for a woman captured in a raid, but taken as a wife rather than a slave. Her children have no clan. It is like being a bastard, somewhat." Then why would she agree to this? Why would Pyotr allow it? And if she is not the Narcheska when she comes to Buckkeep and remains there, do we gain any advantage by this wedding? Chade, this does not make sense to me. There is still too much that is not clear here, Fitz. I sense an unseen current in all this. Stay alert. And so I did. Through the long evening and longer night, the sun lingered as it does in that northern clime, so that night was just a long twilight. When the time came for the bridal couple to retire, it was Dutiful who announced that he would remain below in the common room, lest any say that I have taken what I have not earned. It added another awkward moment to the day, and I saw a puff-lipped Lestra gloating about it with her cohorts. The couple parted at the foot of the staircase, Eliania ascending and Dutiful going off to take a seat beside Chade. This night he would sleep within the mother's house, as befitted a man properly wedded to a woman of the clan, but down here, on the bedboards, not above, with Eliania. His guards were dismissed for the night, to return to the warriors' housing or warmer welcomes, so long as their partners bedded them outside the mother's house walls. I longed to move closer to Chade and Dutiful and have some quiet talk with them, but I knew it would look odd. Instead, I decided that it was time for me to return to my own lodgings. I had not gone far when I heard footsteps crunching on the pathway behind me. Glancing back, I saw Webb. Beside him slogged a weary Swift. The tops of his cheeks were very pink, and I suspected the boy had overindulged in wine. Webb nodded to me, and I slackened my pace to allow them to catch up with me. "Quite an occasion," I remarked idly to Webb when he walked beside me. "Yes. I think the Out-Islanders now regard our prince as wed to their Narcheska. I thought this was only to confirm the betrothal before her mother's hearth." There was a note of question in his statement. "I don't think they make any distinction between couples marrying and couples announcing that they will marry. Here, where property and children belong to the woman, marriage is seen in a different light." He nodded slowly.
"No woman ever has to wonder if a babe is truly hers," he observed. "Does it make that great of a difference if the children belong more to the woman than they do to the husband?"
Swift asked curiously. His words were not slurred, but when he spoke, I could smell the wine on his breath.
"I think it depends on the man," Webb answered gravely.
After that, we walked for a time in silence. Whether I would or no, my thoughts wandered to Nettle and Molly and Burrick and me. To whom did she belong now? As we drew near the cottage, the town around us was silent. Any folk who were not at the wedding festivities in the mother's house were long abed. I opened the door quietly. Thick needed all the rest he could get. I did not wish to wake him. The slice of light that we admitted to the cottage showed me Riddle lying on the floor beside Thick's bed. One eye was open, and his hand was on his bared blade, arranged beside him. When he saw who it was, he closed his eyes and lapsed back into sleep. I remained standing motionless by the door. There was another intruder in the cottage, one whose presence Riddle had not noticed. Large and round as a fat cat, yet masked like a ferret, he crouched on the table, his bushy striped tail sticking straight up behind him. He looked at us with round eyes over the hunk of our cheese that he clutched in his front paws. The marks of his sharp teeth were clearly visible in it.
"What is it?" I breathed to Webb. "I think they call it a robber rat, though rat it is clearly not. I've never seen the like of it before,"
he replied as softly. The robber rat stared past us both, his entire attention fixed on Swift. Like a whisper against my senses, I became aware of the wit flowing between the two. There was a smile on Swift's face. He stepped forward, pushing between Webb and me to do so. I lifted a hand to reach after him, but before I could do so, Webb's hand fell on the boy's shoulder. He jerked Swift back, startling the robber rat with the abruptness of his move. Aloud, he told the creature, "Take the cheese and go!" Then, in the harshest voice I'd ever heard him use, he demanded of Swift, "What did you think you were doing? Have you not heard one word of anything I've tried to teach you?" Robber rat and cheese were gone in a flicker of motion, vanishing through the open window with a flick of striped tail. Swift gave a cry of disappointment and tried to wrench himself free of Webb's grip. The stout man's hand held him firm. The boy was angry, mostly, I think, in response to Webb's visible anger with him.
"All I did was greet him. I liked the feel of him. I could sense that we would go well together, and I wanted—" "You wanted him like a child wants a bright toy on a tinker's tray."
Webb spoke severely, and there was no mistaking the condemnation in his voice as he released Swift's shoulder.
"Because he was sleek and swift and clever. And he is as young and foolish as you are. And as curious. You felt him reach back to you not because he was seeking a partner, but because you intrigued him. That is not a basis for a wit bond, and you are not old enough nor mature enough to be seeking a partner. If you attempt that again, I will punish you, just as I would punish any child who deliberately put himself or a playmate into danger."
Riddle had sat up and was regarding the discussion with open-mouthed astonishment. It was no secret to anyone that both Webb and Swift were part of Dutiful's witted coterie. I shuddered to think how close I had come to betraying myself as old blood. Even Thick had opened one sleepy eye to scowl at the argument. Swift flung himself disconsolately into a chair.
"Danger," he muttered,
What danger? Is it dangerous that I might have someone that cared about me at last?
Danger that you would bond with a creature you know nothing about. Has he a mate and kits at home? Would you take him from them, or remain here on this island when we sailed? What does he eat and how often? Would you stay here with him for his lifespan, or take him away from all others of his kind when we left here, condemning him to remain forever mateless? You took no thought for him, Swift, nor for anything beyond the connection of the moment. You're like a drunk, bedding a young girl tonight with no thoughts for the morrow. It is not a behaviour I can excuse. No true old blood would.
Swift glared at him. Riddle spoke thoughtlessly into the tense silence.
I did not know the Wizard had any rules about bonding with animals. I thought they could bond with any creature, for an hour or a year.
A false perception, Webb said heavily, that many folk not of old blood have about us. It is bound to happen when one people must keep their way secret and unseen. But it leads to the idea that we use animals and then discard them. It makes it easier for folk to think we would bid a bear savage a man's family or send a wolf to kill a flock of sheep. The wit bond is not a man taking mastery over an animal. It is a joining founded on mutual respect for life. Do you understand that, Swift?
I meant no harm, he replied stiffly.
There was no repentance or apology in his voice.
Neither does the child who plays with fire and burns a cottage down. Meaning no harm is not enough, Swift. If you would be old blood, then you must respect our rules and ways all the time, not just when it suits you.
And if I don't?
Swift asked sullenly.
Then call yourself a piebald, for that is what you will be.
Webb drew in a heavy breath, and then sighed it out. Or an outcast, he said softly. I felt that he tried not to look at me as he spoke those last words. Why any man would wish to remain apart from his own, I do not know.
Chapter 11 Weaslington. The attachment that the women have to their clan lands is remarkable. They often refer to tales that the earth itself is made from Ada's flesh and bones, while the sea belongs to El. All land belongs to the women of the clan. The men born into a clan may tend the land and help with the harvest, but the women determine the distribution of the harvest and also decree what crops will be planted, and where and in what proportions. It is not merely a matter of ownership, but a matter of Ada's worship. Men may be buried anywhere, and most often are given to the sea, but all women must be buried within their own clan fields. The graves are honoured for 7 years, during which time the burial field is left fallow. After that, they are ploughed again, and the first harvest from such a field is served in a special feast. While the Out-Islander men are wanderers and may remain away from their home ports for years, the women tend to stay close to the lands of their birth. In marriage, they expect their husbands to reside with them. If an Out-Islander woman dies away from her clan lands, extraordinary efforts will be made to return her body to her clan fields. To do otherwise is both great shame and serious sacrilege for the woman's clan. The clans will willingly go to war to repatriate a woman's body to her home. An Account of Travel in a Barbarous Lands by Scribe Fedren. We were guests at Weaslington, at the Narcheska's mother house, for 12 days. It was a strange hospitality they offered us. Jade and Prince Dutiful were allotted sleeping space on the benches in the lower level of the house. The witted coterie was housed alongside the guardsmen outside the walls. Thick and I continued in our cottage, with Swift and Riddle as frequent visitors. Each day, Chade sent 2 of the guards into the village to purchase victuals. They brought a share to us in the cottage, some to the guards, and the rest back to the mother's house. Although Blackwater had promised to feed us, Chade had chosen this tactic shrewdly. To be seen as dependent on the Narwhal mother's house largesse would be seen as a weakness and a foolish lack of planning. There were good aspects to our extended stay. Thick began to recover his health.
He still coughed and was short of breath if he went for a walk, but he slept more naturally, took an interest in his surroundings, ate and drank, and generally recovered some of his spirits. He still held it against me that I had forced him to travel there in a ship, and that he would eventually have to leave in the same way. Every effort at casual conversation that I made always seemed to lead us back to that bone of contention. Sometimes it seemed easier not to speak to him at all, but then I sensed his anger for me as a simmering displeasure. I hated that things had become uncomfortable between us when I had worked so hard to gain his trust. When I said as much to Chade during one of our brief meetings, he dismissed it as necessary. It would be far worse if he blamed it on Dutiful, you see. In this, you will have to be the whipping boy, Fitz. I knew it was so, and yet his words were no comfort. Riddle spent several hours daily with Thick, usually when Chade wanted me to keep an unobtrusive eye on Dutiful. Webb and Swift often came to the cottage. Swift seemed chastened by Webb's rebuke, and appeared generally more respectful to both Webb and myself. I kept the lad busy with daily lessons, and demanded that he practice his bow as well as his swordsmanship. Thick would come to sit outside the cottage and watch our mock battles in the sheep enclosure. He always cheered for Swift, bellowing his pleasure every time the boy landed a blow with the bound swords we used. I confess that bruised my feelings as much as Swift's thwacks bruised my flesh. It was my own skills, more than his, that I wished to keep sharp, but teaching the boy not only gave me an excuse to practice, it also allowed me to demonstrate my proficiency to the Outislanders. They did not gather to watch, but from time to time I would glimpse a lad or two perched on a nearby wall, eyeing us. I resolved that if I must be spied upon, I would see that the reports of me were that I was not easy prey. I did not think that their scrutiny was casual curiosity. I felt constantly watched in that place. Wherever I went, always it seemed there was someone nearby, idly lingering. I could not have pointed to a single boy or old woman that spied on me, and yet there were always eyes on my back. I felt, too, a sense of danger to Thick. It was in the glances he received whenever we went out, and in the reaction of the folk we encountered. They drew back from him as if he carried contagion, and stared after us as if he were a two-headed calf. Even Thick seemed aware of it. I realized that, without consciously thinking of it, he seemed to use the skill to be less noticed. It was not like his blast of, "You don't see me," that had once nearly laid me low, but more a constant announcement of his unimportance. I stored the knowledge away as something worth discussing with Chade. I had little true time with my old mentor, and the skill messages I relayed to him were brief. We all felt it was more important that he use his skill strength in being available to Dutiful. Chade had also decided that as Peota Blackwater had already discerned that I was a bodyguard for the prince, there was no harm in my more openly pursuing that role. "As long as he does not realize you are any more than that," Chade cautioned me. I tried to be an unobtrusive observer and guard to the prince. Although Dutiful never complained, I think he was uncomfortable with my constant lurking presence. The rest of the settlement regarded Dutiful and Eliania as a married couple now. There was no effort to chaperone them in any way. Only Piotr's presence, as subtle as a standing stone, reminded us that some in the Narcheska's family would see that their relationship remained chaste until Dutiful had fulfilled his end of the bargain. I think Piotr and I watched one another as much as we watched Dutiful and the Narcheska. In a strange way, we became partners. I discovered in that time one of the reasons why the Narcheska was held in such regard by all of the clans, not just Narwhal. This was a culture in which women owned the land and what it produced. I had assumed the wealth of the Wieslington Isle was in its sheep. It was only when I trailed Dutiful and Eliania on one of their hikes across the rocky hills of the island that I came to discover its true wealth. They crested a ridge, with Piotr a discreet distance away from them, and me a distant fourth. As I too reached the rise, and then looked down into the next valley, I gasped. There were three lakes in the valley, and two of them steamed even in the height of the summer day. Greenery was lush all around them, as were the precisely planted and tended fields that patchworked the valley. As I followed them down into the valley, the constant cooling wind faded. I walked down into cupped warmth and the smell of mineral-rich water. The boulders and stones had been cleared from the fields to neatly divide the crops as stone fences. Not only did the crops grow better in this warmer valley, but there I saw plants and trees that I would have judged too tender to flourish this far north. Here, in the harsh out-islands, was an island mellowed by bubbling hot springs into an oasis of gentle warmth and plenty. No wonder the winning of the Narcheska was seen as such a prize. An alliance with she who controlled the food produced here was a valuable thing indeed in these harsh lands. Yet I also had to note that, even in the midst of the summer, many of the fields were left fallow, and workers on the land were not as numerous as I would have expected. Again, the women and girls outnumbered the men and boys, and few of the males were in their prime years. It presented a mystery to me. Here were women, wealthy in land and lacking the workers to farm it. Why were there not more men courting here from other clans, seeking to contribute children to this island of plenty? One early evening, Dutiful and Eliania were jumping two of the scrawny little island ponies that her people used for a multitude of tasks on mail. Their course was a stony meadow at the gently sloping base of a hill littered with boulders, and their makeshift jumps were cut saplings laid across paired boulders. The little ponies amazed me with how high they could leap when badgered into jumping. Sheep had cropped the grass short, and scrub brush fringed the meadow. The deepening blue of the sky arched over us, and soon the first stars would show. They were riding bareback, and Dutiful had already taken two tumbles from his scrawny and willful steed, in his attempt to keep pace with his fearless consort. The girl was wholeheartedly enjoying herself. She rode astride, her yellow skirts bunched and blossomed around her legs. From the knee down, her legs were bare, even her feet. Her cheeks were flushed, her hair wild as she rode with a disregard for everything except showing the prince she could excel him at this. The first time he fell, Eliania had ridden on, her mocking laughter reaching all of us. The second time she actually rode back to see if he was injured, while Piotr caught the nasty little beast and led it back to them. Most of my attention was focused on Dutiful. I felt proud of him for how genial he had been about both falls. "These ponies are as skinny and bony as calves. Trying to keep a seat on one is more bruising than taking the fall when it hops sideways." "Eliania seems to manage it well enough," I pointed out teasingly. At the look he shot me, I hastily added, "It doesn't look easy. I think she admires your tenacity. I think she admires my bruises, the little vixen." I caught a note of fondness in the epithet. As if to distract me from that, the prince added, "Glance to your left, and tell me if you see someone behind the boulders at the edge of the scrub brush." I flicked my eyes that way without turning my head. Something was there. I was not sure if it was a person or a large animal crouched there. The prince remounted and clung to his seat while the pony did a series of wild crow hops across the meadow. His mount was obviously weary of the game, but Eliania's merry laughter rewarded Dutiful's effort to stay on top. He cleared the jump that had previously defeated him, and she saluted him with a flourish. Her enjoyment of the spectacle seemed genuine, and a glance at Piotr showed that a grudging smile lit even his dour face. I joined my laughter to theirs and walked closer to them. "Ride toward that area and take a tumble, and when you do, make sure the pony flees toward the boulders." He skilled a disgusted groan at me, but did as I asked. And when the pony bolted, I sprang up and raced after it full speed, deliberately more chasing him than attempting to catch the creature. Together we flushed a woman, clad all in moss green and brown, from her hiding place. She fled with no pretense of doing anything else, and I recognized not only how she moved, but the very faint scent of her that I caught. Much as I longed to chase after her, I did not. Instead, I skilled what I now knew to both Chade and Dutiful. "That was Henja, the Narcheska's servant from Buckkeep. She's here on the island, spying on us." Neither replied to me save with a wave of dread. I was deliberately awkward at catching the pony. Finally, Piotr came to help me. "We gave that old woman quite a fright," I observed to him as I herded the pony toward him. He seized the recalcitrant little animal by the forelock and looked up at the sky. He never met my gaze. "It grows dark. We are fortunate the prince did not take a worse fall and severely injure himself." Then to our wards, "We should go back now. The ponies are tired of jumping and night draws on." I wondered if he had tried to warn me of a worse danger to the prince than falling from a pony's back. I took him around again. "Do you think that poor old woman is all right? Should we look for her? She seemed quite frightened. I wonder what she was doing behind those boulders." Face and voice impassive, he replied, "She was probably just gathering kindling, or herbs or roots. I do not think we need bother about her." He lifted his voice. "Eliania, the time for fun is over.
We should return to the mother's house.
I saw Eliania's face when you made Henja run. The Narcheska was startled, and now she is frightened.
The brusque nod she gave to Piotr's words confirmed the prince's opinion.
She slid immediately from her pony's back, and then lifted the hackamore from his head, turning him loose on the hillside.
Piotr did the same for the beast the prince had been riding, and suddenly I found myself walking back to the mother's house alongside them. Eliania and Dutiful led the way, and the silence between them contrasted sadly with their earlier merriment. My heart was heavy for him. He was learning to love this out-islander girl, but every time they drew closer to one another, the damned politics of throne and power wedged them apart. I felt a sudden rush of anger and spoke rashly.
That was Henja, wasn't it? That woman hiding in the bushes. She was the Narcheska's servant in Buckkeep Castle, if I recall correctly.
I give the man credit for his composure. Although he could not look at me, his voice was calm.
I doubt it. She left our service before we departed Buckkeep. We both believed she might be happier in the Six Duchies, and thus were glad to release her.
Perhaps she returned to Wieslington on her own. Perhaps she became homesick.
This is not her home. She is not of our mother's house,
Piotr announced firmly.
How odd.
I was determined to be relentless. As a mere guardsman, I would not be expected to possess tact, only curiosity.
I thought that in this country the mother's family was all important, so anyone attending the Narcheska would be of her mother's line.
Ordinarily, yes. Piotr's voice was growing stiffer. No woman of the family could be spared at the time we sailed, so we hired her.
I see. I shrugged. I have wondered, why do not Eliania's mother and sisters attend her now? Are they dead?
He shuddered as if I'd struck a dart in him.
No. They aren't.
Bitterness came into his voice.
Her two older brothers are. They died in Kibal Robred's war. Her mother and her younger sister live, but they are detained elsewhere, on an important matter. If they could be here with her now, they would.
Oh, I'm sure of that,
I replied blandly. I was convinced of the truth of every word he had uttered, and just as certain that I did not have the entire truth.
Late that night, while Thick slept heavily, I skilled as much to Chade. I tried to keep my thoughts to the old man private and separate from my skill link to the prince. I could sense his restless sleep. The undercurrent of the boy's frustration and impatience set my nerves on edge. I tried to set his emotions aside as I communicated to Chade all that had passed between Piotr and me. Chade was annoyed with my bluntness with Piotr, even as he was avidly interested in the man's responses.
There are designs within designs here, like one of the fool's wooden puzzle balls. I am convinced that he and the Narcheska have an agenda of their own, and that not all in her mother's house knows of it. Some do. Almata, for example, and the Narcheska's great-grandmother has been told, but I do not think she can hold the significance in her mind. Lestra and her mother interest me. Lestra stands to become Narcheska when Eliania goes off to Buckkeep to wed Dutiful, yet she seems to vie with Eliania for Dutiful's attention, and I suspect her mother encourages it. Does she grasp that eventually becoming Queen of the Six Duchies might be a loftier ambition than stealing the Narcheska title from Eliania? I do not think Lestra and her mother attach any importance to Eliania's demand for the dragon's head. I think that Lestra's ambition should give both Eliania and Piotr concern, yet they seem to remain aloof, their thoughts elsewhere. Eliania only drives Lestra off when the challenge becomes too blatant to ignore.
Like their fistfight on the night of the wedding. Betrothal, Fitz, betrothal. We do not recognize that ceremony as a true wedding. The prince must be wed at home, in Buckkeep, and the marriage must be consummated. But no, not just that confrontation. Lestra has made several attempts at him since then, usually when the Narcheska is not about.
Does Eliania know?
How could she?
He might tell her, I speculated.
I wonder what would happen if she knew.
I have no desire to find out. The situation is quite complicated enough as it is. Perhaps this is just a rivalry between girl cousins. I wish I understood Henja's role in all this. Is she just some dotty old woman? Or more?
Are you quite sure it was her?
Quite.
It had not been just my eyes that confirmed it, but I would not tell Chade I had scented her,
and that enough of the wolf remained in me to be certain of that sense. Our conversation had wearied Chade, and I let him go to his rest. I checked to be sure the cottage door was latched, and then regretfully closed the window shutters as well. I did not like sleeping in such a tightly closed place. I always slept best when I could feel air moving freely on my face. But after my sighting of Henger that day, I would not give anyone the opportunity to have a clear shot at me. Such was my frame of mind as I settled myself for sleep, and the next morning I tried to use it to account for my nightmares. Yet it was not fair to call my dreams that. There was nothing of terror in them, only uneasiness, and a vividness that was not skill-walking, but something else. I dreamed of the fool, as he had once been, not as Lord Golden, but as a pale, frail lad with colourless eyes. In that guise he bestrode the stone dragon behind Girl on a Dragon, and together they rose into the blue skies. But then suddenly he became Lord Golden, and as he rode behind the carved and soulless girl that was a part of the dragon sculpture that he had called back to wakefulness and life, a black-and-white cloak fluttered out on the wind behind him. His hair was pulled back sleek and tight from his face and bound back like a warrior's tail. His expression was so set and stern that he looked as soulless as the girl whose slender waist he clasped. His hands were bare, I saw in surprise, for it had been a very long time since I had seen him do anything ungloved. Higher they rose into the sky, and higher still, and then suddenly he lifted his hand and pointed, and the girl kneed the dragon to fly in the direction of that slender, pointing finger. Then clouds cloaked them, as if mist enfolded them. I stirred from sleep to find my own fingers set to my wrist in the pale prints he had once left there. I shifted in my bedding, but could not seem to come back to full wakefulness. Pulling my blanket more tightly around me, I surrendered to sleep again. And then I did skill-walk in my dreams, to a most disturbing scene. Nettle sat and chatted with Tintaglia on a grassy hillside. I knew it was a dream of Nettle's making, for never had flowers blossomed so brightly, nor bloomed so evenly throughout the grass. It reminded me of a carefully worked tapestry. The dragon was the size of a horse, and crouched in a way that was not quite threatening. I stepped into the dream. Nettle's back was very straight, and her voice nearly brittle, as she demanded of the dragon, "And what has any of that to do with me?" And in a silent aside to me, "Why did you delay? Didn't you feel me summoning you?"
"I can hear that, you know," Tintaglia pointed out calmly. "And he did not hear you summoning him, because I did not wish him to. So, you see, you are quite alone, if I decide you are."
The dragon suddenly turned her cold gaze on me. Beauty had fled her reptile eyes, leaving them spinning gems of fury.
"A fact that does not escape you, either, I assume."
"What do you want?" I demanded of her.
"You know what I want. I want to know what you know of a black dragon. Is he real? Does another dragon, grown and whole, still exist in the world?"
"I don't know," I answered her truthfully. I could feel her mind plucking at mine, trying to get past the words I gave her to see if I was hiding anything. It was like having cold rat feet run over you in a prison cell at night. Then she seized that memory and tried to turn it against me. I slammed my walls tighter. Unfortunately, that meant that Nettle was also outside them. They both became like shadows dimly cast on a wavering curtain. Tintaglia spoke, and her voice reached me like a whisper of doom.
"Accept that your kind will serve mine. It is the natural order of things. Serve me in this, and I will see that you and yours prosper. Defy me, and you and yours will be swept aside."
Suddenly the image of the dragon loomed large and towered over Nettle.
"Or devoured,"
she offered knowingly. Dread prickled at me. On some fundamental level, the dragon associated me with Nettle. Was it simply that she had always reached me through my daughter, or did she sense our kinship? Did it matter? My daughter was in danger, and it was my fault. again, and I had no idea how to protect her. It did not matter. A moment ago, the flower-studded meadow had reminded me of a tapestry. Then Nettle abruptly stood up, bent and seized her dream, then shook it, as if she sought to shake dust from a rug. The dragon's presence was flung from it and went spinning off into nothingness, dwindling as it went. In that nothingness, Nettle stood and wadded up her dream and tucked it into her apron pocket. I no longer knew where or what I was in her dream, but she sent the words to me.
"You'll have to learn to stand up to her and drive her off. Not just curl up in a ball and hide. Remember, Shadow Wolf, that you are a wolf, not a mouse. Or so I thought."
She began to fade.
"Wait!"
The prince skilled with desperate determination. In some way I did not understand, he caught at her and detained her.
"Who are you?"
Nettle's shock went through me like a wave. She struggled a moment, but when his grip held, she demanded,
"Who am I? Who are you? Who dare to intrude here so rudely? Let go of me!"
Dutiful did not react well to her rebuke.
"Who am I? I am the prince of all the six duchies. I go wherever I will."
For a moment, she was stunned to silence. Then,
"You are the prince?"
Her disbelief was as evident as her scorn.
"Yes, I am. And now you will stop wasting my time and tell me who you are."
I winced at the snap of command in his voice. A terrible silent void stretched all around me. Then Nettle reacted as I had known she would.
"Oh, well, of course I will, since you ask me so nicely. Prince Manolus, I am Queen, I doubt it very much, of the Seven Dungheaps. And perhaps you go wherever you will, but when the ware belongs to me, I will that you do not ever go there. Changer, you should cultivate nicer friends."
I saw what she had done. In the pause, she had seen exactly how he had fastened himself to her, and now, effortlessly, she shook herself free of him and vanished. I jolted awake with her disdain rattling against me like flung pebbles. Torn between awe for my daughter and dread of the dragon, I tried to recover myself. I needed to think what I could do. Instead, Chade pushed his way into my mind. "We need to talk. Privately." His skill trembled with excitement. "Privately? Are you sure you know what the word means?" Why tonight, of all nights, did he have to spy on me?
"Not privately."
Dutiful was furious with both of us as he broke in on our skilling.
"Who is she? How long has this been going on? I demand to know. How dare you train another skilled one and keep her existence concealed from me?"
"Go back to sleep."
Thick's ponderous skilling was between a moan and a command.
"Go back to sleep and stop shouting. It was only Nettle and her dragon. Go back to sleep."
"Everyone knows of her except me. This is intolerable."
Dutiful's skilling held fury and frustration and that terrible sense of betrayal when one discovers one has been excluded from a secret.
"I demand to know who she is, right now."
I fenced my thoughts tightly and prayed, even though I knew it would avail me nothing.
"Chade?"
The prince drove him out of his silence.
"I do not know, my lord."
The old man lied gracefully and without remorse. I both damned and admired him.
"Fitzchivalry?"
Truly there is a power to the naming of a man by his true name. I shuddered at the impact, and then swiftly begged, "Do not call me by that name, not here, not now, lest the dragon be listening." It was not the dragon I feared, but my daughter. Too many bits of my secrets were falling into her hands.
"Tell me, Tom."
"Not this way. If we must speak of this, let us speak voice to ear only." Near me in the dark, Thick pulled his blankets up over his head,